against Aziraphale. "Ugh!" said Shadwell, eyes screwed tightly shut, grey forehead beaded with sweat, not looking down, not looking anywhere. "And off we go, then!" In every big-budget science fiction movie, there's the moment when a spaceship as large as New York suddenly goes to light speed. A twanging noise like a wooden ruler being plucked over the edge of a desk, a dazzling refraction of light, and suddenly the stars have all been stretched out thin, and it's gone. This was exactly like that, except that instead of a gleaming 12-mile-long spaceship, it was an off-white 20-year-old motor scooter. And you didn't have the special rainbow effects. And it probably wasn't going at more than 200 miles an hour. And instead of a pulsing whine sliding up the octaves, it just went put-put-put-put-put, vroosh! But it was exactly like that anyway. Where the M25, now a screaming frozen circle, intersects with the M40 to Oxfordshire, police were clustered around in ever-increasing quantities. Since Crowley crossed the divide half an hour earlier, their number had doubled. On the M40 side, anyway. No one in London was getting out. In addition to the police, there were also approximately 200 others standing around and inspecting the M25 through binoculars. They included representatives from Her Majesty's Army, the Bomb Disposal Squad, MI5, MI6, the Special Branch, and the CIA. There was also a man selling hot dogs. Everybody was cold and wet and puzzled and irritable, with the exception of one police officer who was cold, wet, puzzled, irritable, and exasperated. "Look, I don't care if you believe me or not," he sighed. "All I'm telling you is what I saw. It was an old car, a Rolls or a Bentley, one of those flash vintage jobs, and it made it over the bridge." One of the senior army technicians interrupted. "It can't have done. According to our instruments, the temperature above the M25 is somewhere in excess of 700 degrees centigrade. "Or 140 degrees below," added his assistant. "Or 140 degrees below zero," agreed the senior technician. "There does appear to be some confusion on that score, although I think we can safely attribute it to mechanical error of some kind." Footnote. This was true. There wasn't a thermometer on Earth that could have been persuaded to register both 700 degrees centigrade and minus 140 degrees centigrade at the same time, which was the correct temperature. "But," he went on, "the fact remains that we can't even get a helicopter directly over the M25 without winding up with Helicopter McNuggets. How on earth can you tell me that a vintage car drove over it unharmed?" "I didn't say it drove over it unharmed," corrected the policeman, who was thinking seriously about leaving the Metropolitan Police and going into business with his brother, who was resigning his job with the electricity board and was going to start breeding chickens. "It burst into flames. It just kept on going." "Do you seriously expect any of us to believe?" began somebody. A high-pitched keening noise, haunting and strange. Like a thousand glass harmonicas being played in unison, all slightly off-key. Like the sound of the molecules of the air itself, wailing in pain. And vroosh! Over their heads it sailed, 40 feet in the air, engulfed in a deep blue nimbus which faded to red at the edges. A little white motor scooter. And riding it, a middle-aged woman in a pink helmet, and holding tightly to her a short man in a Macintosh and a day-glow green crash helmet. The motor scooter was too far up for anyone to see that his eyes were tightly shut, but they were. The woman was screaming. What she was screaming was this. "Geronimo!" One of the advantages of the Wasabi, as Newt was always keen to point out, was that when it was badly damaged, it was very hard to tell. Newt had to keep driving Dick Turpin onto the shoulder to avoid fallen branches. "You've made me drop all the cards on the floor." The car thumped back onto the road. A small voice from somewhere under the glove compartment said, "Oil pressure alert. Oh, I'll never be able to sort them out now, she moaned. You don't have to, said Newt manically. Just pick one, anyone, it won't matter. What do you mean? Well, if Agnes is right and we're doing all this because she's predicted it, then any card picked right now has got to be relevant. That's logic. It's nonsense. Yeah? Look, you're even here because she predicted it. And have you thought what we're going to say to the Colonel, if we get to see him, which of course we won't? Well, if we're reasonable... Listen, I know these kinds of places. They have huge guards made out of teak guarding the gates, Anathema. And they have white helmets and real guns, you understand, which fire real bullets made of real lead, which can go right into you and bounce around and come out of the same hole before you can even say, excuse me, we have reason to believe that World War III is due any moment and they're going to do the show right here. And then they have serious men in suits with bulging jackets who take you into a little room without windows and ask you questions like, are you now or have you ever been a member of a pinko subversive organisation such as any British political party? And we're nearly there. Look, it's got gates and wire fences and everything. And probably the kind of dogs that eat people. I think you're getting rather overexcited, said Anathema quietly, picking the last of the file cards up from the floor of the car. Overexcited? No! I'm getting very calmly worried that someone might shoot me. I'm sure Agnes would have mentioned it if we were going to be shot. She's very good at that sort of thing. She began absent-mindedly to shuffle the file cards. You know, she said, carefully cutting the cards and riffling the two piles together, I read somewhere that there's a sect that believes that computers are the tools of the devil. They say that Armageddon will come about because of the Antichrist being good with computers. Apparently it's mentioned somewhere in Revelations. I think I must have read about it in a newspaper recently. A Daily Mail letter from America. August the 3rd, said Newt, just after the story about the woman in Worms, Nebraska, who taught her duck to play the accordion. Said Anathema, spreading the cards face down on her lap. So, computers are tools of the devil? Thought Newt. He had no problem believing it. Computers had to be the tools of somebody, and all he knew for certain was that it definitely wasn't him. The car jerked to a halt. The airbase looked battered. Several large trees had fallen down near the entrance, and some men with a digger were trying to shift them. The guard on duty was watching them disinterestedly, but he half turned and looked coldly at the car. All right, said Newt. Pick a card. 3001. Behind the eagle's nest a great ash hath fallen. Oh, is that all? Yes, we always thought it was something to do with the Russian Revolution. Keep going along this road and turn left. The turning led to a narrow lane with the base's perimeter fence on the left-hand side. And now pull in here. There's often cars here, and no one takes any notice, said Anathema. What is this place? It's the local Lover's Lane. Oh, is that why it appears to be paved with rubber? They walked along the hedge-shaded lane for 100 yards until they reached the ash tree. Agnes had been right. It was quite great. It had fallen right across the fence. A guard was sitting on it, smoking a cigarette. He was black. Newt always felt guilty in the presence of black Americans in case they blamed him for 200 years of slave trading. The man stood up when they approached, and then sagged into an easier stance. Oh, hi, Anathema, he said. Hi, George. Terrible storm, wasn't it?
Sure was.
They walked on. He watched them out of sight.
You know him?
Said Newt with forced nonchalance.
Oh, sure. Sometimes a few of them come down to the pub. Pleasant enough in a well-scrubbed way.
Would he shoot us if we just walked in? Said Newt.
He might well point a gun at us in a menacing way, Anathema conceded. Well, that's good enough for me. What do you suggest we do, then?
Well, Agnes must have known something. So? I suppose we just wait. It's not too bad now the wind's gone down.
Oh.
Newt looked at the clouds piling up on the horizon.
Good old Agnes, he said. Adam pedalled steadily along the road, Dog running along behind and occasionally trying to bite his back tyre out of sheer excitement. There was a clacking noise, and Pepper swung out of her drive. You could always tell Pepper's bike. She thought it was improved by a piece of cardboard cunningly held against the wheel by a clothes peg. Katz had learned to take evasive action when she was two streets away.
"I reckon we can cut along Drover's Lane and then up through Roundhead Woods," said Pepper.
"It's all muddy," said Adam.
"That's right," said Pepper nervously. "It gets all muddy up there. We ought to go along by the chalk pit. It's always dry because of the chalk. And then up by the sewage farm."
Brian and Wensleydale pulled in behind them. Wensleydale's bicycle was black and shiny and sensible. Brian's might have been white once, but its colour was lost beneath a thick layer of mud.
"It's stupid calling it a military base," said Pepper. "I went up there when they had their open day, and they had no guns or missiles or anything. Just knobs and dials and brass bands playing."
"Yes," said Adam.
"Well, not much military about knobs and dials," said Pepper.
"I don't know, really," said Adam. "It's amazing what you can do with knobs and dials."
"I got a kit for Christmas," Wensleydale volunteered. "All electric bits. There are a few knobs and dials in it. You can make a radio or a thing that goes beep."
"I don't know," said Adam thoughtfully. "I'm thinking more of certain people patching into the worldwide military communications network and telling all the computers and stuff to start fighting."
"Cool," said Brian. "That'd be wicked."
"Sort of," said Adam. It is a high and lonely destiny to be chairman of the Lower Tadfield Residents Association. R.P. Tyler, short, well-fed, satisfied, stomped down a country lane accompanied by his wife's miniature poodle, Schutze. R.P. Tyler knew the difference between right and wrong. There were no moral greys of any kind in his life. He was not, however, satisfied simply with being vouchsafed the difference between right and wrong. He felt it his bounden duty to tell the world. Not for R.P. Tyler, the soapbox, the polemic verse, the broadsheet. R.P. Tyler's chosen forum was the letter column of the Tadfield Advertiser. If a neighbour's tree was inconsiderate enough to shed leaves into R.P. Tyler's garden, R.P. Tyler would first carefully sweep them all up, place them in boxes, and leave the boxes outside his neighbour's front door with a stern note. Then he would write a letter to the Tadfield Advertiser. If he sighted teenagers sitting on the village green, their portable cassette players playing, and they were enjoying themselves, he would take it upon himself to point out to them the error of their ways. And after he had fled their jeering, he would write to the Tadfield Advertiser on the decline of morality and the youth of today. Since his retirement last year, the letters had increased to the point where not even the Tadfield Advertiser was able to print all of them. Indeed, the letter R.P. Tyler had completed before setting out on his evening walk had begun, "Sirs, I note with distress that the newspapers of today no longer feel obligated to their public, we, the people who pay your wages." He surveyed the fallen branches that littered the narrow country road. "I don't suppose," he pondered, "they think of the cleaning up bill when they send us these storms. Parish Council has to foot the bill to clean it all up, and we, the taxpayers, pay their wages." The they, in this thought, were the weather forecasters on Radio 4, whom R.P. Tyler blamed for the weather. Footnote. He did not have a television. Or, as his wife put it, "Ronald wouldn't have one of those things in the house, would you, Ronald?" And he always agreed, although secretly he would have liked to have seen some of the smut and filth and violence that the National Viewers and Listeners Association complained of. Not because he wanted to see it, of course, just because he wanted to know what other people should be protected from. Schutze stopped by a roadside beech tree to cock its leg. R.P. Tyler looked away, embarrassed. It might be that the sole purpose of his evening constitutional was to allow the dog to relieve itself, but he was dashed if he'd admit that to himself. He stared up at the storm clouds. They were banked up high in towering piles of smudged grey and black. It wasn't just the flickering tongues of lightning that forked through them like the opening sequence of a Frankenstein movie. It was the way they stopped when they reached the borders of Lower Tadfield. And in their centre was a circular patch of daylight. But the light had a stretched yellow quality to it, like a forced smile. It was so quiet. There was a low roaring. Down the narrow lane came four motorbikes. They shot past him and turned the corner, disturbing a cock pheasant who whirred across the lane in a nervous arc of russet and green. "Vandals!" called R.P. Tyler after them. The countryside wasn't made for people like them. It was made for people like him. He jerked Schutz's lead, and they marched along the road. 5 minutes later, he turned the corner to find three of the motorcyclists standing around a fallen signpost, a victim of the storm. The fourth, a tall man with a mirrored visor, remained on his bike. R.P. Tyler observed the situation and leapt effortlessly to a conclusion. These vandals, he had of course been right, had come to the countryside in order to desecrate the war memorial and to overturn signposts. He was about to advance on them sternly when it came to him that he was outnumbered 4-1 and that they were taller than he was and that they were undoubtedly violent psychopaths. No one but a violent psychopath rode motorbikes in R.P. Tyler's world. So he raised his chin and began to strut past them without apparently noticing they were there. Footnote. Although as a member, read founder, of his local neighbourhood watch scheme, he did attempt to memorise the motorbike's number plates. All the while, he was composing in his head a letter. "Sirs, this evening I noted, with distress, a large number of hooligans on motorbicycles infesting our fair village. Why, oh why, does the government do nothing about this plague of..." "Hi," said one of the motorcyclists, raising his visor to reveal a thin face and a trim black beard. "We're kind of lost." "Ah," said R.P. Tyler disapprovingly.
"The signpost must have blew down," said the motorcyclist.
"Yes, I suppose it must," agreed R.P. Tyler. He noticed, with surprise, that he was getting hungry.
"Yeah, well, we're heading for Lower Tadfield."
An officious eyebrow raised.
"You're Americans? With the Air Force base, I suppose. Sirs, when I did national service, I was a credit to my country. I notice with horror and dismay that airmen from the Tadfield Air Base are driving around our noble countryside dressed no better than common thugs. While I appreciate their importance in defending the freedom of the Western world..."
Then his love of giving instructions took over.
"You go back down that road for half a mile, then first left. It's in a deplorable state of disrepair, I'm afraid. I've written numerous letters to the council about it. Are you civil servants or civil masters? That's what I asked them. After all, who pays your wages? Then second right, only it's not exactly right. It's on the left, but you'll find it bends round toward the right eventually. It's signposted Porritt's Lane, but of course it isn't Porritt's Lane. You look at an ordnance survey map, you'll see it's simply the eastern end of Forest Hill Lane. You'll come out in the village, now you go past the Bull and Fiddle. That's a public house. And then when you get to the church, I've pointed out to the people who compile the ordnance survey map that it's a church with a spire, not a church with a tower. Indeed, I have written to the Tadfield Advertiser suggesting they mount a local campaign to get the map corrected. And I have every hope that once these people realize with whom they are dealing, you'll see a hasty U-turn from them. And then you'll get to a crossroads. Now, you go straight across that crossroads and you'll immediately come to a second crossroads. Now, you can take either the left-hand fork or go straight on. Either way, you'll arrive at the air base, although the left-hand fork is almost a tenth of a mile shorter, and you can't miss it."
Famine stared at him blankly.
I'm not sure I got that," he began.
"I did. Let us go."
Schutze gave a little yelp and darted behind R.P. Tyler, where it remained shivering. The strangers climbed back onto their bikes. The one in white, a hippie by the look of him, thought R.P. Tyler, dropped an empty crisp packet onto the grass shoulder.
"Excuse me," barked Tyler. "Is that your crisp packet?"
"Oh, it's not just mine," said the boy. "It's everybody's."
R.P. Tyler drew himself up to his full height. Footnote, 5'6".
"Young man," he said, "how would you feel if I came over to your house and dropped litter everywhere?"
Pollution smiled wistfully. "Very, very pleased," he breathed. "Oh, that would be wonderful."
Beneath his bike, an oil slick puddled a rainbow on the wet road. Engines revved.
"I missed something," said War. "Now, why are we meant to make a U-turn by the church?"
"Just follow me," said the tall one in front, and the four rode off together. R.P. Tyler stared after them until his attention was distracted by the sound of something going clack, clack, clack. He turned. Four figures on bicycles shot past him, closely followed by the scampering figure of a small dog.
"You! Stop!"
shouted R.P. Tyler. The them braked to a halt and looked at him.
"I knew it was you, Adam Young, and your little cabal. What, might I inquire, you children doing out at this time of night? Do your fathers know you're out?"
The leader of the cyclists turned.
"I can't see how you can say it's late," he said. Seems to me that if the sun's still out, then it's not late."
"It's past your bedtime, anyway,"
R.P. Tyler informed them.
"And don't stick out your tongue at me, young lady."
This was to Pepper.
"Or I will be writing a letter to your mother, informing her of the lamentable and unladylike state of her offspring's manners."
"Well, excuse us," said Adam, aggrieved. "Pepper was just looking at you. I didn't know there was any law against looking."
There was a commotion on the grass.
Schutze, who was a particularly refined toy French poodle, of the kind only possessed by people who were never able to fit children into their household budgets, was being menaced by Dog.
"Master Young," ordered R.P. Tyler, "please get your mutt away from my Schutze."
Tyler did not trust Dog. When he had first met the dog 3 days ago, it had snarled at him and glowed its eyes red. This had impelled Tyler to begin a letter pointing out that Dog was undoubtedly rabid, certainly a danger to the community, and should be put down for the general good, until his wife had reminded him that glowing red eyes weren't a symptom of rabies, or, for that matter, anything seen outside of the kind of film that neither of the Tylers would be caught dead at, but knew all they needed to know about, thank you very much. Adam looked astounded.
"Dog's not a mutt. Dog's a remarkable dog. He's clever. Dog, you get off Mr. Tyler's horrible old poodle."
Dog ignored him. He'd got a lot of dog catching up still to do.
"Dog,"
said Adam ominously. His dog slunk back to his master's bicycle.
"I don't believe you've answered my question. Where are you four off to?"
"To the airbase," said Brian.
"If that's all right with you," said Adam, with what he hoped was bitter and scathing sarcasm. "I mean, we wouldn't want to go there if it wasn't all right with you."
"You cheeky little monkey,"
said R.P. Tyler.
"When I see your father, Adam Young, I will inform him in no uncertain terms that..."
But the them were already pedalling off down the road in the direction of Lower Tadfield Air Base, travelling by the them's route, which was shorter and simpler and more scenic than the route suggested by Mr. Tyler. R.P. Tyler had composed a lengthy mental letter on the failings of the youth of today. It covered falling educational standards, the lack of respect given to their elders and betters, the way they always seem to slouch these days instead of walking with a proper, upright bearing, juvenile delinquency, the return of compulsory national service, birching, flogging, and dog licenses. He was very satisfied with it.
He had a sneaking suspicion that it would be too good for the Tadfield Advertiser, and had decided to send it to the Times.
"Put, put, 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 put. Excuse me, love," said a warm female voice. "I think we're lost."
It was an aging motor scooter, and it was being ridden by a middle-aged woman. Clutching her tightly, his eyes screwed shut, was a raincoated little man with a bright green crash helmet on. Sticking up between them was what appeared to be an antique gun with a funnel-shaped muzzle.
Oh, now where are you going?
Lower Tadfield. I'm not sure of the exact address, but we're looking for someone, said the woman.
Then, in a totally different voice, she said, His name is Adam Young. R.P. Tyler boggled.
You want that boy? He asked. What's he done now? No, don't tell me. I don't want to know.
Boy? Said the woman. You didn't tell me he was a boy. Well, how old is he?
Then, she said, he's 11.
Well, I do wish you'd mentioned this before. It puts a completely different complexion on things.
R.P. Tyler just stared. Then he realized what was going on. The woman was a ventriloquist. What he had taken for a man in a green crash helmet, he now saw, was a ventriloquist's dummy. He wondered how he could ever have assumed it was human. He felt the whole thing was in vaguely bad taste.
I saw Adam Young not 5 minutes ago, he told the woman. He and his little cronies were on their way to the American air base.
Oh, dear, said the woman, paling slightly. I've never really liked the Yanks.
They're really very nice people, you know.
Well, yes, but you can't trust people who pick up the ball all the time when they play football.
Ah, excuse me, said R.P. Tyler. I think it's very good. Yeah, very impressive. I'm deputy chairman of the local Rotary Club, and I was wondering, do you do private functions?
Only on Thursdays, said Madame Tracy disapprovingly. And I charge extra.
And I wondered if you could direct us to...
Mr. Tyler had been here before. He wordlessly extended a finger, and the little scooter went put-put-put-put-put-put down the narrow country lane. As it did so, the grey dummy in the green helmet turned around and opened one eye.
"You great southern pollock!"
it croaked. R.P. Tyler was offended, but also disappointed. He'd hoped it would be more lifelike. R.P. Tyler, only 10 minutes away from the village, paused, while Schutze attempted another of its wide range of eliminatory functions. He gazed over the fence. His knowledge of country law was a little hazy, but he felt fairly sure that if the cows lay down, it meant rain. If they were standing, it would probably be fine. These cows were taking it in turns to execute slow and solemn somersaults, and Tyler wondered what it presaged for the weather. He sniffed. Something was burning. There was an unpleasant smell of scorched metal and rubber and leather.
"Excuse me,"
said a voice from behind him. R.P. Tyler turned around. There was a large, once-black car on fire in the lane, and a man in sunglasses was leaning out of one window, saying, through the smoke,
"I'm sorry, I've managed to get a little lost. Can you direct me to Lower Tadfield Air Base? I know it's around here somewhere."
"Your car is on fire."
No, Tyler just couldn't bring himself to say it. I mean, the man had to know that, didn't he? He was sitting in the middle of it. Possibly it was some kind of practical joke. So instead, he said,
"I think you must have taken a wrong turn about a mile back. A signpost has blown down."
The stranger smiled.
"Yeah, that must be it," he said.
The orange flames flickering below him gave him an almost infernal appearance. The wind blew towards Tyler, across the car, and he felt his eyebrows frizzle.
"Excuse me, young man, but your car is on fire, and you are sitting in it without burning, and incidentally, it's red-hot in places."
No. Should he ask the man if he wanted him to phone the AA? Instead, he explained the route carefully, trying not to stare.
"Oh, that's terrific. Much obliged," said Crowley,
as he began to wind up the window. R.P. Tyler had to say something.
"Excuse me, young man," he said.
"Yes?"
"I mean, it's not the kind of thing you don't notice, your car being on fire." A tongue of flame licked across the charred dashboard.
Funny weather we are having, isn't it?
He said lamely.
Is it? Said Crowley.
I honestly hadn't noticed. And he reversed back down the country lane in his burning car.
Well, that's probably because your car is on fire, said R.P. Tyler sharply.
He jerked Schutz's lead, dragged the little dog to heel.
To the editor. Sir, I would like to draw your attention to a recent tendency I have noticed for today's young people to ignore perfectly sensible safety precautions while driving. This evening, I was asked for directions by a gentleman whose car was... No. Driving a car that... No. It was on fire.
His temper getting worse, R.P. Tyler stomped the final stretch back into the village.
Hi! Shouted R.P. Tyler. Young!
Mr. Young was in his front garden, sitting on his deck chair, smoking his pipe. This had more to do with Deirdre's recent discovery of the menace of passive smoking and banning of smoking in the house than he would care to admit to his neighbours. It did not improve his temper. Neither did being addressed as Young by Mr. Tyler.
Yes? Your son, Adam.
Mr. Young sighed.
What's he done now? Do you know where he is?
Mr. Young checked his watch.
Getting ready for bed, I would assume.
Tyler grinned tightly, triumphantly.
I doubt it. I saw him and his little fiends and that appalling mongrel not half an hour ago cycling towards the airbase.
Mr. Young puffed on his pipe.
You know how strict they are up there, said Mr. Tyler,
in case Mr. Young hadn't got the message.
You know what a one your son is for pressing buttons and things, he added.
Mr. Young took his pipe out of his mouth and examined the stem thoughtfully.
He said. I see, he said. Right, he said.
And he went inside. At exactly that same moment, four motorbikes swished to a halt a few hundred yards from the main gate. The riders switched off their engines and raised their helmet visors. Well, three of them did.
I was rather hoping we could crash through the barriers, said War, wistfully.
That'd only cause trouble,
said Famine.
Good.
Trouble for us, I mean. The power and phone lines must be down, but they're bound to have generators, and they'll certainly have radio. If someone starts reporting that terrorists have invaded the base, then people will start acting logically. And the whole plan collapses.
Huh.
We go in, we do the job, we go out, we let human nature take its course,
said Death.
This isn't how I imagined it, chaps,
said War.
I haven't been waiting for thousands of years just to fiddle around with bits of wire. It's not what you'd call dramatic. Albrecht Dürer didn't waste his time doing woodcuts of the four button presses of the apocalypse. I do know that.
I thought there'd be trumpets, said Pollution. Look at it like this, said Famine. It's just groundwork. We get to do the riding forth afterwards. The proper riding forth, wings of the storm, and so on. You've got to be flexible.
Weren't we supposed to meet someone?
Said War. There was no sound but the metallic noises of cooling motorbike engines. Then Pollution said slowly,
You know, I can't say I imagined it'd be somewhere like this, either. I thought it'd be, well, a big city, or a big country. New York, perhaps, or Moscow, or Armageddon itself.
There was another pause. Then War said,
Where is Armageddon, anyway?
Funny you should ask, said Famine. I've always meant to look it up.
There's an Armageddon, Pennsylvania, said Pollution. Or maybe it's Massachusetts or one of them places. Lots of guys in heavy beards and seriously black hats.
No, said Famine. It's somewhere in Israel, I think.
Mount Carmel.
I thought that was where they grow avocados.
And the end of the world.
Is that right? That's one big avocado.
I think I went there once,
said Pollution. "The old city of Megiddo, just before it fell down. Nice place. Interesting royal gateway."
War looked at the greenness around them.
"Boy," she said, "did we take a wrong turning."
"The geography is immaterial."
"Sorry, Lord?"
"If Armageddon is anywhere, it is everywhere."
"That's right," said Famine. "We're not talking about a few square miles of scrub and guts anymore."
There was another pause.
"Let us go."
War coughed.
"It's just that I thought that he'd be coming with us."
Death adjusted his gauntlets.
"This," he said firmly, "is a job for the professionals."
Afterwards, Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger recalled events at the gate as having happened like this. A large staff car drew up by the gate. It was sleek and official-looking, although afterwards he wasn't entirely sure why he had thought this, or why it sounded momentarily as though it were powered by motorbike engines. Four generals got out. Again, the sergeant was a little uncertain of why he had thought this. They had proper identification. What kind of identification, admittedly, he couldn't quite recall, but it was proper. He saluted. And one of them said,
"Surprise inspection, soldier."
To which Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger replied, "Sir, I have not been informated as to the incidence of a surprise inspection at this time, sir."
"Of course not," said one of the generals. "That's because it's a surprise."
The sergeant saluted again. "Sir, permission to confirmate this intelligence with base command, sir," he said uneasily. The tallest and thinnest of the generals strolled a little way from the group, turned his back, and folded his arms. One of the others put a friendly arm around the sergeant's shoulders and leaned forward in a conspiratorial way.
"Now, see here." He squinted at the sergeant's name tag. "Deisenberger, maybe I'll give you a break. It's a surprise inspection. Got that? Surprise. That means no getting on the horn the moment we've gone through, understand? And no leaving your post?
Career soldier like you will understand, am I right?" he added. He winked.
"Otherwise, you'll find yourself busted so low you'll have to say sir to an imp."
Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger stared at him.
"Private,"
hissed one of the other generals. According to her tag, her name was War. Sergeant Deisenberger had never seen a female general like her before, but she was certainly an improvement.
"What?" "Private, not imp." "Yeah, that's what I meant, yeah. Private. Okay, soldier."
The sergeant considered the very limited number of options at his disposal.
"Sir, surprise inspection, sir," he said.
"Provisionatedly classificitioned at this time," said Famine, who had spent years learning how to sell to the federal government and could feel the language coming back to him.
"Sir, affirmative, sir,"
said the sergeant.
"Good man," said Famine as the barrier was raised. "You'll go a long way."
He glanced at his watch.
"Very shortly."
Sometimes human beings are very much like bees. Bees are fiercely protective of their hive, provided you are outside it. Once you're in, the workers sort of assume that it must have been cleared by management and take no notice. Various freeloading insects have evolved a mellifluous existence because of this very fact. Humans act the same way. No one stopped the four as they purposefully made their way into one of the long low buildings under the forest of radio masts. No one paid any attention to them. Perhaps they saw nothing at all. Perhaps they saw what their minds were instructed to see, because the human brain is not equipped to see war, famine, pollution, and death when they don't want to be seen, and has got so good at not seeing that it often manages not to see them, even when they abound on every side. The alarms were totally brainless, and thought they saw four people where people shouldn't be, and went off like anything.
Newt did not smoke, because he did not allow nicotine to gain entry to the temple of his body, or, more accurately, the small Welsh Methodist tin tabernacle of his body. If he had been a smoker, he would have choked on the cigarette that he would have been smoking at this time in order to steady his nerves. Anathema stood up purposefully and smoothed the creases in her skirt.
"Don't worry," she said. "They don't apply to us. Something's probably happening inside."
She smiled at his pale face.
"Come on," she said. "It's not the OK Corral."
"No, they've got better guns, for one thing," said Newt. She helped him up.
"Never mind," she said. "I'm sure you'll think of a way."
It was inevitable that all four of them couldn't contribute equally, War thought. She'd been surprised at her natural affinity for modern weapon systems, which were so much more efficient than bits of sharp metal. And, of course, Pollution laughed at absolutely foolproof, fail-safe devices. Even Famine, at least, knew what computers were. Whereas, well, he didn't do anything much except hang around, although he did it with a certain style. It had occurred to War that there might one day be an end to war, an end to famine, possibly even an end to pollution. And perhaps this was why the fourth and greatest horseman was never exactly what you might call one of the lads. It was like having a tax inspector in your football team. Great to have him on your side, of course, but not the kind of person you wanted to have a drink and a chat with in the bar afterwards. You couldn't be 100% at your ease. A couple of soldiers ran through him as he looked over Pollution's skinny shoulder.
"What are those glittery things?" he said,
in the tones of one who knows he won't be able to understand the answer, but wants to be seen to be taking an interest. 7-segment LED displays, said the boy. He laid loving hands on a bank of relays, which fused under his touch, and then introduced a swathe of self-replicating viruses that whirred away on the electronic ether.
"I could really do without those bloody alarms," muttered Famine.
Death absent-mindedly snapped his fingers. A dozen klaxons gurgled and died.
"I don't know. I rather liked them," said Pollution.
War reached inside another metal cabinet. This wasn't the way she'd expected things to be, she had to admit. But when she ran her fingers over and sometimes through the electronics, there was a familiar feel. It was an echo of what you got when you held a sword, and she felt a thrill of anticipation at the thought that this sword enclosed the whole world and a certain amount of sky above it as well. It loved her. A flaming sword. Mankind had not been very good at learning that swords are dangerous if left lying around, although it had done its limited best to make sure that the chances of one this size being wielded accidentally were high. A cheering thought, that. It was nice to think that mankind made a distinction between blowing their planet to bits by accident and doing it by design. Pollution plunged his hands into another rack of expensive electronics. The guard on the hole in the fence looked puzzled. He was aware of excitement back in the base, and his radio seemed to be picking up nothing but static, and his eyes were being drawn again and again to the card in front of him. He'd seen many identity cards in his time, military, CIA, FBI, KGB even, and being a young soldier, had yet to grasp that the more insignificant an organization is, the more impressive are its identity cards. This one was hellishly impressive. His lips moved as he read it again, all the way from the Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of Britain, charges and demands, through the bit about commandeering all kindling, rope and igniferous oils, right down to the signature of the WA's First Lord Adjutant, "Praise him, all ye works of the Lord, and fly fornication Smith." Newt kept his thumb over the bit about 9 pence per witch, and tried to look like James Bond. Finally, the guard's probing intellect found a word he thought he recognized.
"What's this here?" he said suspiciously. "About us gotta give you faggots."
Oh, we have to have them, said Newt. We burn them.
Say what?
We burn them.
The guard's face broadened into a grin, and they told him England was soft.
Right on, he said.
Something pressed into the small of his back. Drop your gun, said Anathema behind him, or I shall regret what I shall have to do next. Well, it's true, she thought, as she saw the man stiffen in terror. If he doesn't drop the gun, he'll find out this is a stick, and I shall really regret having to be shot. At the main gate, Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger was also having problems. A little man in a dirty mac kept pointing a finger at him and muttering, while a lady, who looked slightly like his mother, talked to him in urgent tones and kept interrupting herself in a different voice.
It really is vitally important that we are allowed to speak to whoever is in charge, said Aziraphale. I really must ask that...
He's right, you know. I'd be able to tell if he was lying.
Yes, thank you. I think we'd really achieve something if you kindly allowed me to carry on.
All right, thank you. I was only trying to put in a good word.
Yes,
you were asking him to...
Yes, all right. Now...
Do you see my finger?
Shouted Shadwell, whose sanity was still attached to him, but only on the end of a long and rather frayed string.
Do you see it? This finger, laddie, could send ye to meet your maker.
Sergeant Deisenberger stared at the black and purple nail a few inches from his face. As an offensive weapon, it rated quite highly, especially if it was ever used in the preparation of food. The telephone gave him nothing but static. He'd been told not to leave his post. His wound from Narm was starting to play up. Footnote, he'd slipped and fallen in a hotel shower when he took a holiday there in 1983. Now the mere sight of a bar of yellow soap could send him into near-fatal flashbacks. He wondered how much trouble he could get into for shooting non-American civilians. The four bicycles pulled up a little way from the base. Tire marks in the dust and a patch of oil indicated that other travellers had briefly rested there.
What are we stopping for?
Said Pepper.
I'm thinking, said Adam.
It was hard. The bit of his mind that he knew as himself was still there, but it was trying to stay afloat on a fountain of tumultuous darkness. What he was aware of, though, was that his three companions were 100% human. He'd got them into trouble before, in the way of torn clothes, docked pocket money, and so on. But this one was almost certainly going to involve a lot more than being confined to the house and made to tidy up your room. On the other hand, there wasn't anyone else.
All right, he said. We need some stuff, I think. We need a sword, a crown, and some scales.
They stared at him.
What? Just here? Said Brian. There's nothing like that here.
I don't know, said Adam. When you think about the games and all that, you know, we've played.
Just to make Sergeant Deisenberger's day, a car pulled up and it was floating several inches off the ground because it had no tires or paintwork. What it did have was a trail of blue smoke, and when it stopped it made the pinging noises made by metal cooling down from a very high temperature. It looked as if it had smoked glass windows, although this was just an effect caused by it having ordinary glass windows, but a smoke-filled interior. The driver's door opened, and a cloud of choking fumes got out. Then Crowley followed it. He waved the smoke away from his face, blinked, and then turned the gesture into a friendly wave.
Hi, he said. How's it going? Has the world ended yet?
He won't let us in, Crowley, said Madame Tracy.
Aziraphale? Is that you?
Nice dress, said Crowley vaguely.
He wasn't feeling very well. For the last 30 miles he'd been imagining that a ton of burning metal, rubber and leather was a fully functioning automobile, and the Bentley had been resisting him fiercely. The hard part had been to keep the whole thing rolling after the all-weather radials had burned away.
Beside him, the remains of the Bentley dropped suddenly onto its distorted wheel rims as he stopped, imagining that it had tires. He patted a metal surface hot enough to fry eggs on.
"You wouldn't get that sort of performance out of one of these modern cars," he said lovingly.
They stared at him. There was a little electronic click. The gate was rising. The housing that contained the electric motor gave a mechanical groan, and then gave up in the face of the unstoppable force acting on the barrier.
"Hey," said Sergeant Deisenberger, "which one of you yo-yos did that?"
Zip, 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 and a small dog, its legs a blur. They stared at the four ferociously pedaling figures that ducked under the barrier and disappeared into the camp. The sergeant pulled himself together.
"Hey," he said, but much more weakly this time, "did any of them kids have some space alien with a face like a friendly turd in a bike basket?"
"I don't think so," said Crowley.
"Then," said Sergeant Deisenberger, "they're in real trouble."
He raised his gun. Enough of this pussyfooting around. He kept thinking of soap.
"And so," he said, "are you?"
"I warned ye,"
Shadwell began.
"This has gone on too long," said Aziraphale. "Sort it out, Crowley, there's a dear chap."
"Mm-hmm," said Crowley.
"I'm the nice one," said Aziraphale. "You can't expect me to... Oh, blast it, you try to do the decent thing, and where does it get you?"
He snapped his fingers. There was a pop like an old-fashioned flashbulb, and Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger disappeared. Said Aziraphale.
"See,"
said Shadwell, who hadn't quite got the hang of Madame Tracy's split personality.
"Nothing to it. You stick by me, you'll be all right."
"Well done," said Crowley. "Never thought you had it in you." "No," said Aziraphale, "nor did I, in fact. I do hope I haven't sent him somewhere dreadful."
"You better get used to it right now," said Crowley. "You just send them. Best not to worry about where they go."
He looked fascinated. "Aren't you going to introduce me to your new body?"
"Oh? Yeah, yes, yes. Of course, Madame Tracy, this is Crowley. Crowley, Madame Tracy." "Oh, charmed, I'm sure."
"Well, let's get on in," said Crowley. He looked sadly at the wreckage of the Bentley, and then brightened. A jeep was heading purposefully towards the gate, and it looked as though it was crowded with people who were about to shout questions and fire guns and not worry about which order they did this in. He brightened up. This was more what you might call his area of competence. He took his hands out of his pockets, and he raised them like Bruce Lee, and then he smiled like Lee Van Cleef.
"Ah," he said, "here comes transport."
They parked their bikes outside one of the low buildings. Wensleydale carefully locked his. He was that kind of boy.
"So what will these people look like?" said Pepper.
"They could look like all sorts," said Adam, doubtfully.
"They're grown-ups, are they?"
said Pepper.
"Yes," said Adam. "More grown-up than you've ever seen before, I reckon."
"Fighting grown-ups is never any use," said Wensleydale gloomily. "You always get into trouble."
"You don't have to fight 'em," said Adam. "You just do what I told you."
The them looked at the things they were carrying. As far as tools to mend the world were concerned, they did not look incredibly efficient.
"How'll we find 'em, then?" said Brian, doubtfully. "I remember when we came to the open day, it's all rooms and stuff, lots of rooms and flashing lights."
Adam stared thoughtfully at the buildings. The alarms were still yodeling.
"Well," he said, "it seems to me..." "Hey, what are you kids doing here?"
It wasn't a 100% threatening voice, but it was near the end of its tether, and it belonged to an officer who'd spent 10 minutes trying to make sense of a senseless world where alarms went off and doors didn't open. Two equally harassed soldiers stood behind him, slightly at a loss as to how to deal with four short and clearly Caucasian juveniles, one of them marginally female.
"Don't you worry about us," said Adam airily. "We're just looking around."
"Now you just..."
the lieutenant began.
"Go to sleep,"
said Adam. You just go to sleep. All you soldiers here, go to sleep. Then you won't get hurt. You all just go to sleep now. The lieutenant stared at him, his eyes trying to focus. Then he pitched forward.
Coo, said Pepper, as the others collapsed. How did you do that?
Well, said Adam cautiously, you know that bit about hypnotism in the boy's own book of 101 things to do that we could never make work?
Yes.
Well, it's sort of like that, only now I've found how to do it. He turned back to the communications building. He pulled himself together, his body unfolding from its habitual comfortable slouch into an upright bearing Mr. Tyler would have been proud of. Right, he said. He thought for a while. Then he said, come and see. If you took the world away and just left the electricity, it would look like the most exquisite filigree ever made. A ball of twinkling silver lines with the occasional coruscating spike of a satellite beam. Even the dark areas would glow with radar and commercial radio waves. It could be the nervous system of a great beast. Here and there cities make knots in the web, but most of the electricity is, as it were, mere musculature, concerned only with crude work. But for 50 years or so, people had been giving electricity brains. And now it was alive in the same way that fire is alive. Switches were welding shut, relays fused. In the heart of silicon chips, whose microscopic architecture looked like a street plan of Los Angeles, fresh pathways opened up. And hundreds of miles away, bells rang in underground rooms, and men stared in horror at what certain screens were telling them. Heavy steel doors shut firmly in secret hollow mountains, leaving people on the other side to pound on them and wrestle with fuse boxes which had melted. Bits of desert and tundra slid aside, letting fresh air into air-conditioned tombs, and blunt shapes ground ponderously into position. And while it flowed where it should not, it ebbed from its normal beds. In cities the traffic lights went, and then the street lights, then all the lights. Cooling fans slowed, flickered, and stopped. Heaters faded into darkness. Lifts stuck. Radio stations choked off, their soothing music silenced. It has been said that civilization is 24 hours and 2 meals away from barbarism. Night was spreading slowly around the spinning earth. It should have been full of pinpricks of light. It was not. There were 5 billion people down there. What was going to happen soon would make barbarism look like a picnic, hot, nasty, and eventually given over to the ants. Death straightened up. He appeared to be listening intently. It was anyone's guess what he listened with.
He is here, he said.
The other three looked up. There was a barely perceptible change in the way they stood there. A moment before Death had spoken, they, the part of them that did not walk and talk like human beings, had been wrapped around the world. Now they were back. More or less. There was a strangeness about them. It was as if, instead of ill-fitting suits, they now had ill-fitting bodies. Famine looked as though he had been tuned slightly off station, so that the hitherto dominant signal, of a pleasant, thrusting, successful businessman, was beginning to be drowned out by the ancient, horrible static of his basic personality. War's skin glistened with sweat. Pollution's skin just glistened.
It's all taken care of, said War, speaking with some effort. It'll take its course.
It's not just the nuclear, Pollution said. It's the chemical. Thousands of gallons of stuff in little tanks all over the world. Beautiful liquids with 18 syllables in their names. And the old standbys.
Say what you like, plutonium may give you grief for thousands of years, but arsenic is forever.
And then...